Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Bomer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Alana Levine.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Little known fact, as an actor, when you audition for a role on a TV show that says possible recurring when they bring you in, that means the chances of this role being in more than one episode is like zero. But my friends, my guest today, did audition for a possible recurring role on Only Murders in the Building, and guess what? Now he's one of its stars. Welcome Michael Cyril Creighton to the podcast.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey everyone, my guest today is Michael Cyril Creighton. Michael stars as Howard Morris in Only Murders in the Building opposite Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez. And this most recent season also included Meryl Streep, Paul Rudd, Matthew Broderick, a host of others. We'll get into that. Some of Michael Cyril Creighton's other TV credits include The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Dexter, New Blood, A League of Their Own, Dash and Lily, High Maintenance, Bob's Burgers, AJ and the Queens, AJ and the Queen, Two Broke Girls, New Amsterdam, Blue Bloods, Nurse Jackie, Orange is the New Black, 30 Rock, and many more. Creighton played abuse survivor Joe Crowley in Spotlight, the 2016 Academy Award winner for Best Picture. Other films include American Fiction, The Post, Game Night, Paper Spiders, and The Outside Story. On stage, he's been seen in Stage Kiss, The Amateurs, and four world premieres by the Debate Society. He wrote, created, and starred in the WGA award-winning web series Jack in a Box, which was inspired by working in a theater box office for over 12 years. So much more to come, so much more that he did that we're not going to spend time on. Google this great, beautiful artist. But Michael, I am so happy to have you on the podcast today.
I'm so happy to be here. I don't know if I ever told you this when we met back in the day. Do you know that I have a weird obsession with Last Night of Ballyhoo? Like, I saw all of you in it. It was probably my freshman year of high school, of college. And I came back for break and I saw Jessica. And then I saw Cynthia, and then I saw you, or whatever the order was. And I don't know what it was about that play, but it was just, I saw it so many times and I loved it so much. And that's how I got introduced to your work, which I loved. And then you were famous to me. When I saw you in Kissing Jessica Stein, I was like, it's La La Levine.
Well, thank you for saying that. And I remember, so I met Michael officially when he did this Sarah Rule play called Stage Kiss. And I remember watching you. It's the first time I met Todd Almond and you, and those were my takeaways from this play. I knew Danny Jenkins, I knew Jessica, Dominic, my husband was in the play, but I remembered watching you and going, this is a comedic genius in front of me who also brings such like deep, deep truth to this part. And I feel like that combination of hilarious and like gravitas and like really grounded in truth and feeling is something that like I see this trajectory of your work where it like brings together this like all of you. And I mean, Spotlight, obviously, when I saw you in that, and I'm sure everyone says this to you, like it's haunting and beautiful. And the idea that the same actor is Joe in Spotlight and Howard in Only Murders in the Building in some ways makes complete sense to me.
Yeah, that's the funny thing is that I did Stage Kiss. I don't know if you know my story, is that I worked in the box office of Playwrights Horizons for 12 years. Yes. And, or I think it was 12 years. And I left And because I went to do a play at Williamstown, and I was like, this is my way out. Like, I have 2 weeks up in the Berkshires, and then my career is going to start. And then I ended up working at another customer service job as soon as that play was over. But my first day of training, I got an audition for Stage Kiss. And I almost didn't go because when I read it, it didn't seem like the character was physically my type or that it was going to be my type. And I was very careful when I worked at Playwrights never to, I always just did my job. I wasn't like, I'm an actor, put me in this, put me in that. So right. I sort of like, is this a favor, whatnot? But I ended up going on my lunch break from training for that other job, and I got it. And that's why I ended up in Spotlight, because the director of Spotlight's agent saw Stage Kiss and somehow translated what I was doing in that crazy, hilarious farce and said, this is a guy you got to see for Joe Crowley. And they didn't. And then she called them again and said, you got to see this guy for Joe Crowley. And that's how it happened. I couldn't figure out how someone saw me in Stage Kiss and translated that into such a completely different part, but I'm starting to understand the connections with all of it.
Yeah. Because there's like this beautiful, I mean, comedy is many things, but it's also cover, right? It's deflection, right. It's cover. And there's a vulnerability just to you and your person. And I think what a smart producer. So when you went in, did you read for Tom McCarthy? Did you get put on tape?
No, I just got put on tape. And then I waited for a long time. And I worked really hard on it because I got the script and I read it. And I was like, oh, I understand this guy in such a deep way. I just know that man. And then I started to do a little research to try to find out, oh, it's a real person. And oh, I found an article somewhere where his nickname, it came out that his nickname was Princess. And I was like, okay, well, that's funny. He's a funny guy. So I did all this research before the audition. I worked on the accent really more than I normally would, because there's nothing worse than a bad Boston accent, which I have been guilty of at times. And then I just went in and taped for it. And I taped once, just once. And that was it. And then I waited for a long, long time. And then it was very fast. So then I got the job. I was suddenly going to Boston to meet the man I played. I was in a rehearsal with Tom and Rachel. And that was it. And I always say that, like, the I think that performance is what it is because I spent such a long day with the man I played. And then once the movie ended, we actually stayed in touch for quite a long time until he passed. But I credit him to the performance because he is all those things. He is deeply vulnerable, extremely wounded, but covers it so well with comedy. I think when I called him, I left him a message and I said, hi, this is Michael. I'm going to be playing you in a movie. I think we probably have a lot to talk about. And he left me a message back and was like, well, I was always hoping it would be Gina Davis, but I guess you'll do. And so we got along very well.
Wow. So what does that mean, like, for listeners who haven't had an opportunity to play a real person or just fans of the film? What does that mean to spend the day with someone? Is it like a blind date? Is someone with you guys sort of chaperoning?
No, it was like a blind date. Like, I didn't know what he looked like. We had spent an hour or two on the phone, and they didn't say I had to meet him, but he was open to meeting me if I wanted to. And I felt like that would be important. So when I talked to him on the phone, I was like, wow, this man is so resilient. And so he's really come so far. The damage is so deep, but he's really, he seems to be doing so well. And then when I saw him in person, I saw like what the physical damage was of a lifetime of trauma, which was really interesting because he was so good at covering it with humor and over the phone and the quips but in person I saw him, I saw some of the damage that was done. He was the best. He was so funny. I have thousands of text messages from him, and like, he was a talker. He was, we just kind of met, we talked, he told me his story. I was very careful not to get super emotional about it because that was not my place there to like take on his thing. And I sort of observed how he moved a little and how he deflected quite a bit. And just sort of the next day I was filming and it just sort of was there. Yeah. And just also meeting him and feeling his essence was informed the scene so much, because he was just so lovable and likable. And what was done to him was so awful and really threw him off course. And it made me wonder what his life would have been like had it not happened to him, you know?
You know, before we get into one amazing breakout role after another in the last few years, but as, you know, listeners heard, a big body of work before these breakout sort of parts happened, or just the perfect opportunity to showcase your unique talents. Can we go back a little bit in your own life and sort of your growing up and who was in the house and how you found the arts and a little bit of your own history?
Yeah, sure. I have a single mom. She's young. She was like, I believe 17 when she had me. So I grew up with my mom, her three sisters who were all younger than her, and my grandparents in their house. And then
where was that?
That was on Long Island, in North Shore of Long Island. And then when I got to be probably 12, I think we moved next door, me and my mom, to the house that my grandmother grew up in. So me and my mom lived next door to my grandparents, and they still live next door to each other now. I went to Catholic school my whole life. My whole first through 12th grade, didn't love it, but went, and sort of, I don't know how it happened, but I told my aunt I wanted to take acting classes at this theater in Port Jefferson, which was a town in Long Island. And, she got me an acting class, and then, I did a like little Alice in Wonderland, I think, sort of play. And then I got to high school and I was like, I'm going to be well-rounded and I'm going to play football. I don't know what made me think I could or wanted to play football. I have no interest in sports whatsoever. I just really had this idea that I was going to be everything. I was like, I'm going to play football and do plays. And then the football thing quickly was like, no, I'm not going to try out. I don't want to. And just started auditioning for plays. And that's sort of how I figured out what I wanted to do in high school. And then I went to Emerson College for acting.
And you grew up in like, it's not an unprecedented situation, but I can't imagine that like everyone in your class was raised by a super young single mom and her extended family.
Yeah.
Was that sort of front and center for you, or this is your reality and it was normal for you, or were you very aware of that being a unique familial scenario?
I think I was aware of it being unique, but I also wasn't ashamed of it. Like, I certainly wasn't, I wasn't ever like, oh, I wish there was a father in the picture. Like, I never felt like I was missing anything because I had all of these like hilarious women and an excellent grandfather, and my uncle. So I had like a close family that was taking care of me, and I was lucky because they were all sort of close to me. So it was like this weird hybrid sister aunt, sister mother sort of thing. And it was like my grandparents were the ones that were like the parents that we were all afraid of.
Right.
But for me, it wasn't odd. I mean, it got odd when I got into high school, and then like, you know, certain nuns would have certain opinions about premarital sex and single motherhood and whatnot. And I would, anonymously speak up in notes here and there, just being like, I don't think it's very Christ-like to be judging a single mother. You know, obviously everybody knew who that note was coming from, but I
writing with your anonymous left hand.
I know. As a woman, like, I'm like trying to like
make it
yeah.
Exactly.
But yeah, no, it was just my reality. And it was also like, I think what made me who I am is like, I just had all these really funny Irish Catholic women around me that sort of influenced my sense of humor and the way I interact with people. I don't know how I got into how I do what I do. Cause I was thinking about this earlier. It was like the worst thing you could be in my family, or the worst thing you could be called when I was growing up was conceited. Like, uh-huh. You know, and like there is,
it's all about humility.
Yeah. And that's like my whole like family unit. It's a unit is all about humility. It's not about being conceited. It's not about showcasing. And so I actually do feel like I'm always sort of two things at once. Like I'm a very confident, insecure person, or I'm like a very outgoing introvert, or I'm a very, you know, so it's interesting. Like, it's just like not, no one in my family does what I do. And I don't think they understand it.
First of all, starting in the theater and coming up, you know, when we came up. I think so much of like the mission statement is and working with the great Sarah Rule and certain writers, it's being in service of the writer, being in service of the script. And I feel like sort of that mantra, I think allows people. I grew up in a household very like a very similar vibe, which is like don't show off. You know, my mother was not the typical Jewish mother who would show everyone, you know, pictures of her grandchildren and be like, this one's a doctor, this one's a lawyer, even though this one was a doctor and this one was a lawyer.
Right.
Even though that was very much what would happen at, you know, the lunch she would go to.
Yeah.
And so I do think like looking at it as I'm actually an artist in service of something bigger.
Yeah.
But then there's a lot of attention that comes with it too. And people at a stage door wanting your signature. And I've told this story before, but Alan Alda, who was the lead of the first play I ever did in Jake's Women, on the rare occasion, he would go to the stage door really because he just wanted fresh air and like to get some food.
Yeah.
He would ask whoever asked him for an autograph to also like give him their autograph, you know, it became super complicated.
Yeah, I bet.
Like, but I don't have an extra playbill to sign. Right. I mean, I was fine. Like, Alan, just if you could sign and then we could all.
Yeah, we could go.
Exactly. But like the kind of depths he went to sort of equalize the fan and artist experience. But all that being said, was it Catholic school because that was the tradition in your family, or the schools weren't great in the neighborhood? So we'll say
it was the tradition in the family. It was, and I should say, just going back, that my family is super supportive of it all. It's just so out of their experience, although it's not, because the Catholic Church and the Catholic Mass is so theatrical. I mean, like the dresses and the outfits and the glass, the stained glass and the sets and like, so
and the entrances and the exits. From
there's like, it's very theatrical. Yeah. But no, it's just it was like my whole family always went to Catholic school. And then my mom taught at my high school. So I got to go for free. So that was like sort of a no-brainer. Like it was a Catholic high school that was a good high school that I could go without paying tuition. So that was what I did for high school.
And when you came to New York, did you come and see theater growing up? Or I know a lot of people on Long Island who actually still haven't been to Manhattan. Like there are
I know. Isn't that crazy?
Yes, it is.
What the heck?
I don't know. Were you coming in to see stuff?
Yeah. I started pretty young. Like my family did like theater and we would go see I forget what the first thing I saw was. It might have been Little Shop of Horrors, or it might have been Nonsense or something like that. I remember being young seeing those things. But I saw a lot of musicals with my family. And like, it would be like once a year, we'd go see a big musical, my grandparents and my mom and me. And then I remember the first straight play I ever saw, I don't know what year it was Indiscretions. Do you remember that play?
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
It was, I just couldn't get over it. Like I'd never seen a straight play before. And I was like, I still remember how it visually ended. I loved everybody in it. So yeah, that was what we would do. We would see theater. And I, when I got out of college, I lived on Long Island for like a year, I think, or a year and a half, and would commute into the city for my day job, or night job. It was both. I worked at Drama Department, the theater company, which was my internship in college when I'd come home for the summers. And I worked in the office, and then I would do stage crew at night. And then I would take the train back to Long Island and do it all over again. Until I eventually moved to Astoria, which is where I have been forever.
So I feel like Spotlight really helped move the needle in terms of your visibility and people kind of going, that's like a really special actor. And then looking and going, oh, he's been around for a while. This is just a great showcase for his beautiful talents. But Only Murders in the Building, which is now in its third.
We're about to start the fourth season.
The fourth season. So I'm watching the third season.
Yeah, we haven't started the fourth, but yeah, just finished the third.
Right. So first of all, you know, as I caught up this season and the opening credits begin, they're just beautifully illustrated opening credits with Michael Cyril Creighton walking in front of the building, or someone that feels very much like you.
Yes.
This cast has embraced you, and you've embraced them in this ensemble. I guess I don't know how much you're allowed to talk about your experience of working, first of all, just starting with Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez. Mm-hmm. What is the dynamic? What is the set life like? What is the world of working on Only Murders in the Building?
It's incredible. It is. I mean, I am keenly aware now that not all jobs are created equal, as we all know. And this is just one that I will love every minute that I am able to do it. There is nothing to complain about. If I ever think of anything to complain about, it goes in a different box, because like the day-to-day experience of doing the show and being with those people is unreal. Like, I mean, it's a masterclass. It's a great hangout. It's so satisfying as an actor and as an audience member to watch to the things I've gotten to watch be made. I think it comes down from the top. Our showrunner, John Hoffman, is just the greatest guy. And Steve Martin and Selena are just so kind. They are very open. They are they treat every actor with such respect, be it a day player or, you know, Shirley MacLaine. Every actor they seem interested by and fascinated with, and they're complimentary. And it seems very sincere. They're it's the best. And when I did the first season, it was supposed to be one episode, or no, it was one episode, two episodes. And the first episode I did, it was before vaccines and everything, and I got COVID. So the second episode, they could have very easily written me out, because I had a scheduling conflict that was going to bump right into it. But they waited the 14 days until I was better. And then just to be extra safe, they filmed me alone. So I filmed my whole big episode in the first season alone. And I was pretty devastated about it, because I thought this is my chance, was my chance to act with Steve Martin and Selena Gomez. And now it's over. And Martin Short. Well, that was nice, but that was it. And then I couldn't even imagine where I am now, that I'm a regular. Like, it just kept going. They kept writing for me. The writers are incredible. It's really the best. It's sitting watching, like, and then it gets better and better. Sitting watching Paul Rudd do act like an idiot for like an hours and hours, just be such a jerk to everybody, was so funny. Watching Meryl Streep sing that song. And during that day when Meryl was singing the lullaby, at one point Steve Martin turned to me and all the other guest stars and day players and co-stars, and he was like, "This feels like a really special showbiz moment, doesn't it?" Mm. So it's not even lost on them how special the show is. It's just really, like, I have to say, it's the nicest job. It's such a fun character. The people are so wonderful, from the crew to the cast. And I feel very lucky. And this is a really good stretch, this job.
It is incredibly dialogue heavy. And it really, you know, I think about Maisel, which you were also on. I feel like you guys are asked to speak a tremendous amount of dialogue at a very quick pace. Your show moves so quickly.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of you. And it feels like when you watch it, obviously it's very meta this season. It is a play, literally a play within the show. But is there Aaron Sorkin pressure a la West Wing, where it's like you have to be word perfect and it moves really quickly? Is there room and improv, and, you know, everyone is so funny, and
it doesn't feel like there's ever pressure, but it's always ends up being word perfect. Like, the writing's so good. It's one of those cases where the writing is so good that it's just very easy to memorize, I find. And you don't really, I mean, Maisel definitely is like, they have that, like, say it this fast and say all these words and don't deviate. And sort of, I went to a different part of my brain doing Maisel, because it was like, oh, it's really just talking fast and same words. Like, and it does the job. This is a little different because it's there's so much character under all of these characters, I guess you'd say. And so yeah, like we play around a little bit. There's usually like a fun take maybe at the end, but generally it's sticking to the script. And it never feels rigid though. It always feels really fun. Someone asked me the other day, the showrunner's husband said, you know, people ask me if you actually talk like that. And I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, Howard has a very specific minced way of speaking. I'm not even aware of it, but if I sit back and think about it, yes, obviously he has got
I do speak like that because I guess sometimes, to a certain degree, but yes. there's a sort of iambic pentameter to the right, like yeah. There's a rhythm built in. So when you began, and as you said, it was just meant to be the idea that like possible recurring or a two episode arc, maybe recurring, has turned into like the opening credits are the four of you.
Unreal.
Which is just fantastic. And I'm sure everyone in Port Jefferson is screaming with pride about their local. So just talk a little bit about like, I don't know if there was a table read at the beginning of the season and Meryl and Ashley and Paul and Jeremy, Seamus, like is everyone there and Andrew, like is everyone there?
Yeah, we do it on a Zoom. Like we've only done table
reads. Still Zoom life in a way.
Yeah. The only one that we didn't do on Zoom was the finale because it was like we were in the middle of filming something. Okay. And everybody was in the same place. But we do it on Zoom. And that's a crazy feeling of like being on a Zoom and seeing all of these icons in their natural habitat.
You're like screenshot.
Yeah, like eating yogurt or like you know, just like, you know, being like, where do I look for the script? Like everybody sort of on equal footing. You know, I always have a ring light so that I can look as good as possible. No one cares. But like, you know.
Is that the first time you interacted with Meryl on that first Zoom read through?
No, because I met her during the post, when we did the post. But I still like, I mean, she'll always be Meryl Streep to me. I feel like I'm able to, because I interact with Steve Marty and Selena so much that I'm able to be a little bit more loose with them. Although I do find like in general, this has always been my thing. Don't speak just to speak or take up space just to take up space. Like I usually only talk if I have something to add to the conversation or if I think it'll kill, you know what I mean? Like I'm not like they're running my mouth in the green room all the time.
Totally. I get it.
But Meryl, it was something I couldn't get past that was Meryl Streep. You know what I mean? I don't think
that
I ever
was just normal life. Has Taylor Swift come to visit the set?
No. Could you imagine? Could you imagine? I guess I could, but no, she has not.
Okay. That's all. We're yeah. Done. That's all I really We're done.
That's all I wanted to know. Oh no, because I was planning on coming to visit the set. Yeah.
So how did you handle being on Maisel and did only Murders in the Building and Maisel happen at the same time or
yeah, how did I was that work? I mean, I think I'm lucky. I think part of the reason why I am a regular now is because I kept booking work that would conflict with Murders episodes. So like in the first season, part of the reason why we had to shoot me alone and I couldn't do it later is because I was immediately going to work on Dexter New Blood and they were in first position. And then second season of Murders, I got Maisel at the tail end and then it became a real sort of tricky thing to make that schedule work and to get me into that finale with all the fainting in season two, which is what was one of my favorite things to do. But it was
all the fainting.
Yeah. So that was tricky. That was like it would become. I would actually call the first AD on Murders and be like, "I'm
yourself.
Done." Like, yeah, I would just text. Like the middlemen were doing what they could do.
Right.
But sometimes I'm like, I'm just going to tell you that I'm done at one. And I can, if you pick me up from here, I can come there and do a little bit. So it all worked out. I think everybody was afraid that I couldn't do both at the same time. But here's the secret to everybody. Everybody can do both at the same time. So if everybody just makes it work, it can work.
Yeah.
But I was really lucky that Murders was so flexible during that time. And Yeah, but I was doing them concurrently near the tail end.
Well, can you talk a little bit about, did you watch Maisel? Were you a fan of the show?
Yeah, I was a fan of Maisel. I thought that was, it was one of those things. I had auditioned for the pilot, and then I had, it's very hard for me, or it was hard for a long time to say no to auditions. That's not how my brain worked. But I sort of had to train myself to be like, sometimes you have to believe that there's something better down the line in a specific show. And so I did pass on a lot of auditions from Maisel, because a lot of them, when I would read them, I was like, I don't see what I can add to this. And it seems like it would be just a blip.
You mean for guest spots going
for guest spots? Yeah. Like,
didn't get the pilot.
Yeah. And I wasn't right for the pilot at all. But I also, these guest spots that came up, some of them weren't right, I didn't feel like I could pop in them or whatnot. And then I have auditioned for other parts though on the show. And then when this came around for the last season, it just was such a great match. I mean, it was such a different version of myself that I haven't been able to play on screen. It was such a great, I made such great friends on it, because it was this unit of guys playing writers.
Writer's room, yeah.
So we just spent a lot of time together, and I really, really liked them a lot. Rachel, watching her work is like so incredible and fascinating, because she's so precise every single time. She's just incredible. She does not falter. She is perfection. And wow. And it's such a hard thing to do. It is so hard to talk that fast and be that funny. And
also she's probably often exhausted, right? Like,
yeah, but I've never saw her complain in 8 months. I never saw her complain once. And so I feel like I've been pretty lucky to see, like, really have really incredible tops of the call sheet on most of the shows I've done.
Yeah.
No real bad eggs at all. And so that was really cool. It was like also cool to be in a period piece and neat to be on these big lavish sets, and the way the Paladinos work is so different than the way only Murders directors work. And I really liked their vibe. And so it was cool. I loved it. I mean, I love doing it.
Can you talk a little bit about auditioning? Because maybe now, because you've sort of done a lot of work as Howard and a lot of work on Maisel, and they are very different characters. You know, the great Bill Butler has plenty of tape to send out now for the one person who doesn't know who you are. But talk to me about, you know, people are often surprised at how much actors still have to audition and read. Even when they're a series regular on something, what's your process?
It's changed a lot. I think I'm not a good in-person auditioner in general. I love self-taping. I really do. I love a Zoom audition. I love a Zoom audition. I just love a little bit of distance from that moment of, like, the thing that makes me nervous is being myself walking in the room and saying goodbye and then saying three things too many. Like, you know what I mean? Right. Like just
or
stop.
Also just switching gears from the banter, the hello, or like, yeah. Oh my God, the subway. And then
that feels so inauthentic to me. I'd rather just do the scene.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like my career really took off. Like, not took off, but I really started working once I didn't think I could ever work again during the pandemic, when I thought it was all over. Like, it took all the pressure of all what I thought auditions should be and what I thought I should be doing. I feel like something lifted. And then because it all seemed not real, it seemed like we were never going back to work. It seemed like these tapes were just like, well, I might as well have fun and there was no pressure, because I didn't think I just have gotten into the sense of thinking it's not real. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, this is my chance to have fun as a character. And that's where it ends, you know? So I try to, and I've tried to make the self-taping as civilized and, you know, easy on myself as possible. Sometimes I won't memorize everything. Sometimes I will. I actually do the scenes often with a recording of someone else and just edit myself out so that I don't have to waste anyone's time, because that was always a problem. But as far as like the material, I just try to approach it the way I approach everything, which is, you know, find both sides of what's going on, you know, find the humor under the darkness and the darkness under the humor and all that.
You did a lot of producing, creating, and making your own content. So for so many people who just dealing with editing is either a brand new or an impossibility,
right.
You already have filmmaking skills. Like you already know with nothing to make something.
Yes, that is a big plus for sure.
Yeah, like I can. You can do the thing you just described where you record in it. Like I don't know what you mean. So I'm saying
right. Right. Yeah.
Something, you know, that idea of like the 10,000 hours in one thing that Malcolm Gladwell talks about that sort of ends up being the thing that allows you to be really comfortable in a moment where so many people are so uncomfortable having to do all this stuff for themselves.
Yeah.
So that's kind of amazing. So all of these jobs happened post-COVID.
I mean, Dexter murders. Either during or post Dexter, Murders, Maisel, American Fiction, all of that is all post COVID. New Amsterdam, like just stuff that New Amsterdam had 100 and something fever because I had just gotten a COVID shot and I was like, I don't want to do this tape, but I'll do it. There's just, I do love self-taping. I just think I like the control of it and I like the, and I've gotten to a point where I'm not spending hours and hours and hours on it. I'm making it a little bit more pleasant and enjoyable. So, yeah, but I audition all the time. It's very rare that I get an offer just out of nowhere.
So do you feel successful?
That's such a weird, I constantly am like, what does it take to feel successful? Or what is success? And what does that mean? I feel like I belong let's say this. Okay, so during the strike, for the first time in forever, I felt like I belonged to a community and I was exactly where I was supposed to be. I don't always feel that in theater at all, really. You know, there's always sort of the sense of like, watching it from the outside, because I was always watching everything from the box office, even when I was part of it. It was sort of, I always have this sense in all things of watching it from the outside, because I've always been like the guy who worked in the office or the guy who worked in the box office or the person who worked for the production company. I don't know if I'll ever shake that, but when I was on the picket line with all of these actors that I've admired for so long, that I've known or known about for so long. And then we were all sort of just on equal playing field. It just made me feel like, wow, I do belong. I have, and that felt like a success to me. I feel I'm proud of my career because I think it could have gone several different ways and I've made some really smart choices, I think. There was definitely a path where my whole career could have just been playing guys that work at shops that are nasty to women buying dresses. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. And I like that kind of character. But if that was all I was doing, it's not one sustainable. It's two, not good for my psyche. And I had so much more to show. So I think I do feel successful. I feel like I've showed colors of the person that I am, of the actor that I am and the characters that I can play and have not let myself be as limited as I think some would keep me. Does that make sense?
Yes. I wanted to ask if it was meaningful to you to be that Howard had a boyfriend, a boyfriend on the show. Did that thrill you?
Yes. I mean, it's amazing to play a gay character with a full life. I had been on other shows where I had a husband and all we did was stand next to each other. We never had, you wouldn't even know we were husbands if they didn't just put it in the breakdown. You know what I mean?
Right. Have romance and vulnerability
and to set that up. And then it's just there. And that's part of his reality. Now that's part of his life. You know, that felt like an extreme gift. And I do feel a great responsibility to be like, there's not a ton of gay guys that look like me having careers that are varied like that, or having love interests or being more than just the sidekick and whatnot. So I feel lucky and proud and happy that they added that in for sure. And I'm always sort of try to be thoughtful as far as the roles I pick, as far as where it's coming from in that sense, sort of.
If you have a chance, if you've ever had a chance to kind of sit with your showrunner writers, have they ever told you, like, why they were so clear that Howard, because there were a lot of characters in the first season that lived in the building. They didn't know how many seasons they would have, although the trifecta of stardom leading the show was, there's a good bet they would get a season two
at
the very least. But also, would Martin and Steven Salina want to do it? Like, there are a lot of unknowns at the beginning.
Right.
How long they would have want, you know, are they going to love this and want to stay with it? And clearly they do and did. Did anyone ever say to you, like, I just want you to know, this is why we wanted you to be a long part of this family? Do you have a sense of what that is?
I have a sense of it. No one's said it outright, but I do know that I personally feel like I'm my best on that set. Like, I just am, like, in all ways, you know, I'm not always the best person. I'm not always, sometimes I can be negative, whatnot. I'm just my best version of myself there as an actor and as a person. And I do think that the trio really likes me and respects me. And that, you know, just came with just being myself around them and not trying to impress them, even though all I wanted to do was impress them, you know?
Right.
So I think that we have a good rapport. I get along with the showrunner. I love the material so much. I always want to honor the material. I don't know how it happened, but it's one of those jobs where I'm so lucky that everything sort of pointed in the right direction and they kept me around, because they, you know, there's a lot of apartments in that building. There's a lot of characters and people come and go, and it has nothing to do with whether they're great actors or likable or anything like that. It just is, like, the way the story goes. I don't know what has kept me around. I mean, part of me knows what it is, you know, but I'm grateful for it. I'm so happy. Like, thank God.
Well, I just have to say, as someone who's had the privilege of knowing you for a long time, I think every once in a while, there's this lightning in a bottle thing where the person and the part converge in such a beautiful way that it's undeniable. Before I let you go, Michael, is there a little known fact about you that you can share?
We thought about this because I'm sort of an open book. But there is a little known fact that I am the master of two very specific, not that great impressions. One is specifically Julia Child on the HBO show Julia, calling for her husband. And the other is Bjork complimenting your fingers. So those are two impressions that I do. Should I do them? Do you want me to do them?
I would be honored.
I guess I have to. Hopefully it will come off well over Zoom. So this is, clear my throat. This is Julia on Julia calling for her husband.
Oh, Paul, Paul, oh, Paul, Coco Vaughn, Paul, oh, Paul.
So that's that. And then Bjork complimenting your fingers.
Alana, you're such a creative creature. Your fingers are long and they're green.
So those are my two not that great impressions that I have mastered.
Michael Cyril Creighton, I love you. I thank you for being here today and sharing so much of you with
all of us. Thank you for having me.
Until next time, my sweet.
Until next time. Thank you. You're such a great host.
Clouds can make the wind blow.
I have some news. Little Known Facts is now available to watch on YouTube. Hours and hours and hours of interviews that you can see my fabulous guests. And guess what? It's called Little Known Facts with Alana Levine. Catchy, right? Anyway, head on over to YouTube and watch the podcast. And please don't forget to subscribe. Also, if you want to donate to the podcast, zero pressure. But if you want to, no donation is too big or too small. I am so grateful for you for listening. But if you want to donate, just go to littleknownfactspodcast.com/donations. Lastly, Little Known Facts is recorded in Brooklyn, New York, USA. My editor is Nicholas Klar. None of this happens without Nicholas. And the Little Known Facts theme song was composed and sung by Georgia Famusa with backup vocals by Caleb.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.